and welcome. Today is April 6th, 2016. And tomorrow is a significant day. Tomorrow is Chaitra Shukla Paksha in the Vedic calendar. Tomorrow is effectively the beginning of the new year. And the way that is calculated is, astrologically, not casually and just to demarcate a given day as the starting date, like we do with the Gregorian calendar, January 1st. That's the beginning of the year. Based on what? On what astronomical or astrological reality is that based on? Nothing. So, Chaitra Shukla Paksha. Chaitra is the name of the month. And the months in the Vedic calendar go from roughly the middle of our month to the middle of the next month. So, for example, here we are. Tomorrow will be April 7th. So this month, Chaitra, would have begun on the middle of March. I say the middle. I could tell you the date. I just don't have the date in front of me right at the moment. But it's usually 13th, 14th, 15th, 16th, somewhere in there, to the middle of the next month. So middle of March, middle of April. But it's calculated. I'm just giving you the general thing here. And what's going to happen tomorrow is the sun and the moon are going to go like this and be together. And they are going to have Congress, and they're going to create the new year. The sun is the male energy, and the moon is the female energy. There are two luminaries, or planets, that give light out of all the planets. Sun, moon. When you read the Vedas, also Bhagavad Gita, in different places, Krishna says, Vishnu says, that the sun and the moon are my eyes. So the sun and the moon are very important because they're luminaries. So when the male energy and the female energy meet and have congress, then pregnancy takes place and something is produced or born. The reason tomorrow is the day is because the sun and the moon will be at the exact same degree in Pisces. Why Pisces? I thought that the zodiac begins. What's the first sign of the zodiac? Do you know? Aries. Starts with Aries, ends with Pisces. So how in the world could it be Pisces? Because what they fail to take into consideration in Western astrological calculation, because it's based on the movement of the sun, it's tropical astrology, sun's movements through the tropics, Tropic of Cancer, Tropic of Cancer of Capricorn. They fail to take into account that as the earth spins on its axis, it has a slight wobble. So what they say in Western astrology is that on or about March 21st, 22nd, is the first day of spring. That's reasonable. They call it the vernal equinox, the spring equinox, equal day, equal night. Equinox, equinoche, equal night, equal day. And at that time, the sun enters where? 0 degrees of Aries, first sign of the zodiac. But because the earth has this wobble, see, even that has a bit of a wobble. It's like a spinning top, you know, it spins and then it goes. But that's what, that wobble's always there. It causes this equinoctial point, this vernal equinox point, to actually go backwards. Each year, it regresses. It goes backwards. Or precesses is the word they use. How do we know that? Because in the Vedic system, all calculations are lined up with the fixed stars.
So if they're at 6 degrees tomorrow, 100 years from now, there might be 5 degrees and then 4 degrees and 2 degrees. Is that the way they're going? Or are they
opposite? They're going backwards. Exactly.
So 200 years from now, they might be in Capricorn.
No, Aquarius. Yeah, they will be. 2446 will be the year. Dawning of the Age of Aquarius. Have you heard? This is the dawning of the Age of Aquarius. 2446 is the age of beginning of the Age of Aquarius. Sun will be in springtime, 0 degrees of Aquarius. Okay, so let me finish the explanation. So in the Vedic system, which is, we call it, in the Western system is tropical. The sun in the tropics. The Vedic system is sidereal. Sidereal means stars. So we line up the signs. Each sign, Aries, has 30 degrees in length. Next one, Taurus, 30 degrees. Next one, Gemini, 30 degrees. 12 times 30 is 360. It has to be calculated. Everything must be exact in terms of mathematical calculation. So the first constellation, which is called in Sanskrit nakshatra, is Ashvini. Ashvini is the horse. We have present with us somebody whose moon was in Ashvini when she was born, the first constellation of the zodiac. That's Kalindi. So 0 degrees of Ashvini tells us where 0 degrees of Aries is. When? This year, next year, 5 years? Always. Doesn't change. The so-called fixed belt of stars or constellations, every time we see them in the sky, they have the same relationship to each other. They don't move around. Yeah, they move as we move, because we move. But they don't move in relation to each other. So that is a fixed point we can measure with. You follow me? So each year, because we're talking about now degrees, minutes, seconds. So each year, this equinoctial point goes backwards 50 seconds. Not degrees, not minutes, seconds. So you say, that's nothing. That's not even important. Of course it's important. It's astronomical calculation. So as of now, it's precessed some 23 degrees backwards.
When did this age of Pisces begin? Do
you know? I don't have the date. I'm sorry. It began a long time ago. Piscean age. Yeah, I mean, like 2,000 or 3,000 years ago, something like that. So, what they think is 0 degrees Aries in Western astrology, first day of spring, is in reality 6 degrees of Pisces, having gone backwards. Okay. Another 6 degrees, and you've got the next sign, Aquarius. That's where you get the age of Aquarius from. It's a calculation. It's not like somebody made up some cool thing, the age of Aquarius. No. It's actually something that exists. And the closer they get to it, the more the influence is there. The symptoms of the age of Aquarius are technology. And I was looking at a video the other day And now they're seeing technology run rampant when the robots are actually going to control everything and get rid of us because we're superfluous. I can't imagine it, but that's what they said in the video. Okay, so that's why tomorrow, Sun and Moon, exact same degree in Pisces, begins the year. And Shukla Paksha means, Paksha is a fortnight. So in a fortnight, 2 weeks, the moon waxes, right? And then it wanes for the next fortnight, right? So Paksha, Shukla means it's going to begin to wax. Tomorrow is the Amavasya, the new moon. The new moon is when the sun and the moon are exactly together. So that's what we have tomorrow. And that gives birth to the new year. And I won't get into all this again, but as we said, you know, it was two months ago, that this year is going to have Rahu and Jupiter together. This is when you calculate all of the yearly charts for the different countries in the world, which is called mundane astrology. You can calculate the US chart, Irish chart, France's chart, UK, any chart you want. And of course, all of those charts calculated from tomorrow will have Jupiter and Rahu together in the sky. Jupiter is money, finance, income, economy, cash flow, investment. And with Rahu, the shadow, that means the bottom is going to fall out of something at some point in the coming year, highly likely. And since they haven't really done anything to rectify the problems we had in the last crash, 08, 09, it's not a stretch to understand that that may well take place. But anyway, tomorrow is the day when it all begins. According to Drew Lawrence's monthly planetary planner, tomorrow's a gold day. Today's a gold day. Tomorrow's a gold day. Why? Because Sun and Moon will be together in Pisces, but Venus is also there right now in Pisces. So you're going to have Sun, Moon, Venus, and Venus, which of course is the planet of love.
So in a lot of ways, the next year is going to be very nice.
In some ways it'll be really nice. It might bring some enlightenment and greater compassion. And Venus is exalted in the sign of Pisces. It's as powerful as it can be. And Pisces is actually a planet of compassion, philanthropy, altruism, humanitarianism, you know. So, if that increases in the world, that will be a good thing. It depends where the planets end up in the charts of these different countries, you see. You can't just, you're right, Venus with Sun and Moon is wonderful. But where do the planets actually end up in the charts? And what kind of influence will they have? In general, it's a very good influence, no question. And if Sun is purpose, identity, responsibility, authority, control, organization, power, government, corporations, people in positions of power and authority, that's all the sun. Being with exalted Venus, maybe there'll be some degree of enlightenment coming in from such people. I haven't seen a lot of that. Moon is the mind, the heart, the emotions. So when we're talking on this level, then Moon becomes the cosmic mind. So Moon being with exalted Venus would mean the mind is in a very positive state, a loving state. Venus is love. So there's love for self, there's love for your loved one. In relationship, there's love for your family. There's love for your nation. There's love for humanity. There's universal love. There's love of God. So that's the ladder of love. So it depends where you want to go with that and to what degree you want to embrace others. So it's favorable. Venus and Moon together is a highly, highly creative combination. So something wonderful creatively could come out of it. So that's what's happening tomorrow. So it would be good to meditate on the welfare of the world, particularly. Maybe we should do that this evening. But it would be good to do that tomorrow for the benefit of the world as a whole. Clindy and I were talking about this the other day. The highest souls that are on the planet, and some of them have been on the planet since a previous millennia, even back to Dwapara Yuga. You say, well, how could that be? Nobody could be. There are really, really high beings who do nothing but meditate. And they won't show up in the city center. They don't come to such places. They may be in a cave in the Himalayas, or, I mean, who knows where they all are. Some of them are there. They can be in different places. They can move around. But what they do is they don't engage in welfare activities in terms of let's go feed people and let's go deal with governmental issues. They just meditate on the welfare of the world. They meditate on the universal benefit, or sometimes directed to specific places like Earth. So we can do that too. There's no reason. We all can't do that. Only these souls, it's believed that many of them keep the whole thing going because we do so much here that's counterproductive. And there's so much corruption and there's so much...
Regardless of how much good intention
you have, there's always ego somewhere. Yeah, exactly. That's a good point. How do you know if you're making a contribution as opposed to a non-contribution or having a negative effect on the world around you? How do you know that? What is behind your actions? What's your motivation? If your motivation is genuinely to be helpful, to be kind, to be understanding, loving, to make a contribution, without the need for your own recognition, then that would be a product of self, as self in the positive sense, spiritual self, as opposed to ego.
No, I mean from the point of view that even if the person has any sort of ego with anything on a daily basis, what they're meditating on is tainted.
Yes.
They may be doing a particular thing in the right mode, but other things in their life are tainted with ego.
Yeah, so you mean they're not on the same level as somebody else that that isn't tainted with ego. Yeah. And if you're tainted with ego, I mean, depending what level you're on in your spiritual development, you know, you're going to have that much spiritual potency. It's going to have an impact on others, or not so much of an impact. You know, when Prabhupada was here on the planet, and I got to, well, not spend a lot of time with him personally, but saw him a lot and listened to him a lot. It was somebody without ego who was just acting and working for the benefit of everybody. I've only seen that once or twice in my entire life. I saw it again, in fact, in Bengal with one of his godbrothers. I'm not saying that there isn't other people around. There are. But they're hard to come by. They're hard to find. So, any comments?
Would Babaji be one of those models?
Which Babaji?
Well,
there's many Babajis. You mean the one from?
I suppose Yogananda's line, yeah, his lineage.
Oh, that Babaji. Yeah, I'm not sure. Maybe. I don't think he's here anymore.
Who's the guy?
Babaji.
Karina.
In Nainital. That's a Babaji that was recently here. I know a lot of people that are followers of that Babaji in Nainital in North India and I think the foothills of the Himalayas.
He's a Shaivite, but he stayed young for decades. And these are all Westerners that were hanging out with him.
Yeah, they would have been with him for decades.
40 years, and he still looks like
him. Yeah, he never aged.
The day they met him. And then all of a sudden one day he just disappeared.
Yeah, so he was there and then he was gone.
And you'd see photographs of these people, like his peers, getting older and older and older. This guy is in the photograph, he looks exactly the same.
Yeah, we know many of the disciples.
And they were saying when they met him, you know, he was supposedly a couple of hundred years old. But he looked like he was 20.
Yeah.
It's amazing. I wouldn't believe it only for the fact that I saw the photographs with my own two eyes.
Yeah, they showed you the photographs, yeah. Yeah, I have a lot of his followers that are clients of mine. Well, let's talk a little bit about the Brahmasamhita. This book, Brahmasamhita, Samhita is book, and Brahma is the creator of the diversity in the universe. We've talked about Brahma lots of times. When Chaitanya was here on the planet 500 years ago, that's Chaitanya in that painting there on the right in the saffron. And this is Chaitanya on the altar on the left. The same two, Nityananda Chaitanya, in there, dancing, singing, dancing mode. He went on a tour all over India, all over South India. And he went through the old temples. They're still there, a lot of those temples. We've been to several of them. I've been to several of them. So is Clint. And they have old libraries where the books are, you know, written on palm leaf manuscripts. So they're long, thin pieces like this. And when you read them, you just flip them over, and they got a hole on each end with some
twine
going through. And you read, and you go like this. You read, and you go like this. And these books, there's books, I've seen books like this, handled them. And he came upon, Chaitanya came upon this book, the Brahmasamhita, but only one chapter. That's all that was extant. That's all that seemed to survive. And this is the fifth chapter of the Brahmasamhita. No 1 to 4 and nothing beyond. This is all that was there. So he got somebody to copy it, because that's the only thing you could do. You got to get somebody to sit down, a scribe, and copy it, which he did. And so we have it. This is an amazing, amazing book. It's, to be honest, it's very advanced. It's very advanced for most of us, no offense, including me. It's an advanced book. So, we'll just read a little bit of it. Now, we've talked about the story of creation according to the the Vedas. This sculpture here, we talked about this before. So that is Vishnu, as Garbhadakshayi Vishnu. And he lies down on the Sheshanaga, the serpent couch, on the Garbhadak ocean at the bottom of each universe. The universe is an egg or a globe in shape, which it is. At the bottom of the universe, there's water. It's kind of like the amniotic fluid concept. And he lies down and he goes into a mystic sleep. And in this case, the lotus flower springs from his navel. And upon the lotus flower, Brahma appears. That's a very small Brahma there, but there he is. And Brahma is in charge of creating the diversity within the universe, which does not harmonize with the Big Bang theory of creation. So here it says, on coming out of the lotus, Brahma, being guided by the divine potency, turned his mind to the act of creation under the impulse of previous impressions. But he could see nothing but darkness in every direction. Creation is in what mode? Is it in the mode of goodness, the mode of passion, or the mode of ignorance? Is it sattva? Is it rajas?
Passion.
Or is it tamas? It's passion. Mode of passion, or the mode of desire, gives an impetus to act, to make something happen. If you want to get a good example, a good glimpse of the mode of passion, go into the middle of any city, and you'll be surrounded by it. Everybody's going somewhere, doing something, impelled by, largely, the mode of passion, rajas. Brahma, in the act of creation, is also under the influence of the mode of passion. Brahma is not God. He's not God energy like Vishnu is, or Krishna is full-on God energy. He is Jiva. He's a soul, like us. He's a much higher soul than we are in the sense of his capacity, his consciousness, and what he's capable of doing. For example, some people can run a multinational corporation. Pardon? Not Obama.
Out of Panama, I said.
Oh, sorry, I said Obama. Out of Panama. The Panama Papers just came out. Some people could run a multinational corporation, for example. I mean, effectively. And some people can't do that. So it doesn't mean that one is better than the other. It means that one has a capacity or a capability for doing something on a whole other level. That's the point. So Brahma has the capacity to create diversity in the universe. Now, if you're attracted to this concept or this job, this position, you too could become Brahma. You could put in your CV, your resume, and take the job interview, because a jiva is appointed to be Brahma. So he's here to create. So that's the first impetus. Now it says here, turned his mind to the act of creation under the impulse of previous impressions.
He was thinking too much of Jurassic Park when he started here.
Is That one came out of left field. Do you want to explain that one?
Makes sense, doesn't it?
Yeah, he's going too far back in time. He's created a bunch of dinosaurs. Yeah. Okay, yeah, could be.
I made a mistake there.
Yeah.
Could have wiped those eyes.
Well, actually, if you read about Brahma's creation in the Bhagavatam, you will find that he did make mistakes. And there were a few of the prototypes that he had to be, how shall we say, gotten rid of because they weren't up to par. It's true. Yeah. Because we're in the material world. Everything in the material world is covered by some fault, some flaw. Like smoke is covered by, fire is covered by smoke. Dust is covering a mirror. Okay. Here is the point. Under the impulse of previous impressions, what does that mean? Under the impulse of previous impressions. It means he's in this particular lifetime as Brahma to create all the life in the universe, but he's coming in under the impulse of his previous lifetime in all lifetimes and all the impressions, the imprints that he received in all the things that happened and that he did in previous lifetimes. That's why he is in that position. So, why is this important point? Because it's exactly the same thing for us. You come into this lifetime and you are placed in a certain geographical location in a family, a certain family, or not. Maybe your family isn't there for you. Maybe your family is there for you. Or maybe one of your parents dies when you're, 1 year old. I mean, so many different things. You're coming in under the impulse of previous impressions. Which means you do what? You pick up where you left off. So that's what this means. And what's the Sanskrit word for impressions? Sanskaras. Exactly. So I'm going to read this purport here. It's quite short. Brahma's impulse for creation arises solely from his previous impressions. All jivas, that's us, get their nature conformably to their impressions of previous births. And accordingly, their activity can have a beginning. It is called the unseen or the result of one's previous deeds. His natural impulse is formed according to the nature of the deeds done by him in the previous, this says, in the previous kalpa, in the previous creation, you know, in his case. Some of the eligible jivas also attain to the office of Brahma in this way. That's what I said earlier. So that's how you end up in the situation you're in. And then, of course, sometimes people manifest wonderful talents and abilities naturally. They just possess them. Well, they didn't learn, they didn't study, not yet. How can they do that? Because they've done all that. And they come in with those abilities. Then it says, the next verse, then the goddess of learning, Saraswati, the divine consort of the Supreme Lord, said thus to Brahma, who saw nothing but gloom in all directions. There's nothing, darkness. O Brahma, this mantra, namely, Kling Krishnaya Govindaya Gopijana Vallabhaya Swaha, will assuredly fulfill your heart's desire. Now, the Saraswati...
I didn't know you got that from there.
That's where it comes from. Hmm. Saraswati is the goddess of learning, patron of the arts. The Saraswati they're talking about here, it is not a Saraswati that appeared in the physical world, because you can read in other places where Brahma creates Saraswati as one of the his creations. In that case, that is a Saraswati that is a product of the material world. In this case, this Saraswati is, as it says here, consort of the Supreme Lord. She is spiritual in nature. So if she's spiritual, she's already existing. So she impels or inspires Brahma with a mantra. So this mantra is a very, very high mantra, meaning it's a very, very high vibration. Klim is a what? That's the first word in the mantra. Klim. Shrim. Aim. Kshaum. Bija mantra. Bija mantra. Correct. Seed mantra. So Klim is known as a Kama. Kama Bija. Kama meaning desires. You want to fulfill desires? Klim.
Is it Klim or Kling?
It's either. If you were in South India, you would say Klim. If you were in North India, you say Kling. Kling. Either. So then you go more of a nasal. Kling or Klim. Either. It's spelled K-L-I-M. But when they put the dot over the M, it becomes an anuswara, which means you can pronounce it as a nasal sound, like kling, as opposed to kling. It's a long I. Kling, 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 not a short I. So, kling, kling Krishnaya Govindaya Gopijana Vallabhaya Swaha. Swaha is like, instead of a nama, they say swaha. It's like swaha is usually the mantra they use when they pour sacred offerings of ghee onto the sacred fire. Swaha, and they pour a little bit of ghee on the fire. So it's an offering. Krishnaya, onto Krishna. Govindaya, who's the protector of the cows. Gopijana Vallabhaya, who's dear to the gopis, to the milkmaidens. Swaha, and will assuredly fulfill your heart's desire. So the purport says, this mantra, consisting of 18 divine letters prefixed by the Kama Bija, Klim, is alone super excellent. It has a twofold aspect. One aspect is that it tends to make the pure soul run after the all-attractive Krishna and the Lord of Gokula and the divine and his divine milkmaidens, the gopis. This is the acme or the topmost position of the spiritual tendency of the jivas, of the souls. When the devotee is free from all sorts of mundane desires, that's what's hard to do, to become free of mundane desires, desires connected to the body. When the devotee is free from all sorts of mundane desires and willing to serve the Lord, he attains the fruit of his heart's desire, namely, love of Krishna, love of God. If we're all running around looking for what? What are we looking for? We're looking for love. That's what we're all looking for. From whom? One person? No. We're looking for love everywhere. Ideally, we want a loving reciprocal relationship with everybody and everything. Right? What's an example? Saint Francis of Assisi. In Christian history, theology. He was a monk. What kind of monk was he?
Franciscan.
Franciscan. St. Francis, Franciscan, yeah. All the animals would come to him. The birds would alight on him. all the animals, right? Do they do that with everybody? No. Why not? They know better. Because he had this vibration that all the animals came to him. He was such a loving soul that he didn't look down on the animals. The animals are a person. It was all the same to him. They're all souls. And the animals knew that. When Chaitanya was on his way to South India, he would go through the jungles and he would chant and dance. And he would chant Krishna's names. And all the animals would come. And they sort of go behind him, almost like the Pied Piper. Tigers. Back then they had lions in India. Every kind of animal, deer, I mean animals that are natural enemies, they would all come and follow him. So we're looking for, I'm just using that as an example, that we want loving relationships with everyone, you know. You know, the joke is the relationship a man has with his mother-in-law. You know, this is the difficult, the prickly relationship. If a man's mother-in-law actually likes him and they get along, that's a good thing, you know. You know, comedians tell all kinds of jokes about that. So you want to have good relationships with everybody. So the highest relationship, if you have a loving relationship with God, that's it. You reach the top of the mountain. Therefore, everybody beneath you will have a good relationship with, theoretically, a loving relationship. But in the case of the devotee who is not of unmixed aptitude, this super excellent mantra fulfills his heart's desires also. So what is that saying? Well, supposing you don't have pure desires, just pure spiritual desires connected to God, then what? Then your mundane desires, your material desires connected to the body, and the mind will also be fulfilled.
It's a
foolproof
mantra.
It's foolproof
mantra.
That's right. The transcendental kama bija is inherent in the divine logos located in Goloka. Divine logos means God, in the personality of God. And the kama bija, pervertedly reflected in the worldly affairs, satisfies all sorts of desires of the mundane world. In other words, you got it covered. There's a verse in the Srimad Bhagavatam that says, Akama sarvakamo va moksha kamo udaradi tivrena bhakti yogena yajeta purusham param. Akama, if you don't have any desires. Sarvakamo, if you have all kinds of desire. Sarvakamo va moksha kamo, if your desire is for moksha,
liberation
from repeated birth and death. Moksha kama udaradi, if that is your mentality, that's what you're meditating on. Tivrena bhakti yogena. Tivra means very focused, very dedicated practice of bhakti, of devotion to God. Tivrena bhakti yogena. Yajeta, in which case, yajeta, you should worship yajeta purushamparam, the Supreme Person. The Supreme Person. So, in what condition, in what case should you worship Krishna? If you have no desires, if you have every desire in the book, or if your desire is simply to get out of the material world, the world of birth and death, doesn't matter. So that says this in a different way. So you want to learn this mantra? It's pretty short. I didn't write it down for you, but it's pretty easy. Clean.
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 Krishnaya.
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 Clean Krishnaya.
Clean Krishnaya.
Clean Krishnaya.
Clean Krishnaya.
Clean Krishnaya.
Clean Krishnaya.
Govindaya.
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 Okay, now we'll do three words. Clean Krishnaya Govindaya. 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 Gopijana. Gopijana. Gopijana.
Gopijana.
Gopijana.
Gopijana.
Gopijana.
Gopijana.
Gopijana.
Gopijana.
Clean, and I'll do the phrase. Clean Krishnaya Govindaya Gopijana. 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 Next word. Valabhaya.
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 Vallabhaya.
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 Okay, the whole phrase. Clean Krishnaya Govindaya Gopijana Vallabhaya. 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 Swaha.
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 Swaha. Okay, I'll do the whole complete mantra. Kling Krishnaya Govindaya Gopi Janavalabhaya Swaha. Kling Krishnaya Govindaya Gopi Janavalabhaya Swaha. Or you can do it still in rhythm. Kling Krishnaya Govindaya Gopi Janavalabhaya Swaha. 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 Good mantra, huh?
It's amazing. When you're, it was like each bit of the mantra was a string. And a string, and a string, and a string, and a string. And as they all started to come together, they twisted into a rope, almost like a DNA.
Hang on to it, because up you go.
It's amazing. I've never seen a mantra like that.
No? Clindy sees all these images. It's normal for her. She sees the energies. Kling Krishnaya Govindaya Gopijana Vallabhaya Swaha. 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 So you can chant the mantra like we did at the beginning in a musical rhythmic way. Or you can just Kling Krishnaya Govindaya Gopijana Vallabhaya Swaha. Kling Krishnaya Govindaya Gopijana Vallabhaya Swaha. As you like, you can drive down the street. Kling Krishnaya Govindaya Gopijana Vallabhaya Swaha. Kling Krishnaya Govindaya Gopijana Vallabhaya Swaha. Kling Krishnaya Govindaya Gopijana. Bending. Who's driving next to you? Never know. So then Saraswati says, tapastvam tapa etena tava siddhir bhavishyati. O Brahma, do thou practice spiritual austerity, tapa, by means of this mantra, and then all of your desires will be fulfilled. That's a reasonable translation, but it says tava siddhir bhavishyati. The Sanskrit actually says, then you will become perfect. You will attain perfection. That's what the Sanskrit says. So you could say, yeah, all your desires will be fulfilled. Yeah. Because that would be a symptom of becoming perfect. So, Brahma then chanted that mantra. He went into meditation. Kim Krishnaya Govindaya Gopijana Vallabhaya Swaha. For 1,000 years or some such thing. As you do. Some people do. The next verse, Brahma, being desirous of satisfying Govinda, Krishna, practice the cultural acts, in other words, the mantra, for Krishna in Goloka. Goloka is where Krishna lives in the spiritual world. The Lord of Shvetadvip is an island, which is a spiritual island, but is situated in the material creation. And so I won't get into all of that. So he practiced it, it says here, for a long time. His meditation ran thus. Now this is what he saw when he practices. This is the vision that then appeared. When? On the first day? I don't think so. In the first year? Probably took a while. There exists a divine lotus flower of 1,000 petals.
The stem.
What's the stem? The mantra is the stem.
Sorry, you put it together.
That's it. There's the stem. The umbilicus. But he's not talking about this one. He's talking about in the spiritual world. Not this particular one. You're right. That's what it is.
Sorry.
That's it. There exists a divine lotus flower of 1,000 petals, augmented by millions of filaments. In the transcendental land of Goloka, that's the spiritual world, topmost part. On its whorl, center part, there exists a great divine throne upon which is seated Sri Krishna, the form of eternal effulgence. What's effulgence?
Brightness,
illumination, of transcendental bliss. Playing on his divine flute, resonant with the divine sound. The Shabda Brahma, the divine sound, with his lotus mouth. That's how you play a flute, with your mouth. He is worshipped by his amorous milkmaids with their respective subjective portions and extensions, and also by his external energy, who remains outside of the spiritual lotus, embodying all mundane qualities. So when it says the milkmaids, these are the gopis, with their respective subjective portions and extensions, their handmaidens. So there's many and many and many of them, and that's what you find at the topmost level. In other words, these are manifestations of the pleasure potency, the Hladini Shakti, the loving potency, as expressed in female form, who adore, worship, and have eyes for only God. That's the concept. And then his external energy, which is what creates this world, that female energy as well is there, but not within the mainstream, just outside, because it deals primarily with the material energy. So I'll do one more verse here, because I'm skipping a couple of verses, and I'm going to now where Brahma starts the Govindam prayers. Govindam Adi Purusham Dhammam Bhajami Govindam Adi Purusham Tamaham Bhajami Venam Kvanantam Aravinda Dalayataksham Bharhavatam Samasitam Burasundarangam Kandarapako Tikamaniya Visheshashobam Govindam Maripurusham Tamaham Bhajami. Translation. This is what he comes to, and now he goes on and on and on, verse after verse. I worship Govinda, the original person, who is adept in playing on his flute, with blooming eyes like lotus petals, with his head bedecked with a peacock feather, the figure of beauty tinged with the hue of blue clouds, and his unique loveliness charming millions of cupids. That's the verse. What is the concept of charming millions of cupids? What is the most powerful force in the material world? What would you say? Love. And the most powerful force of love is the attraction between male and female. Even that attraction toward the female polarity and the male polarity. What to speak of the attraction for the body, the opposite sex, and all the rest of it that goes with it. When people, we say, are struck by the arrow of Cupid, they fall in love. Cupid, in the Vedic conception, is actually a demigod. They don't call him Cupid. They call him Kamadeva or Kandarpa. That's another name for him. So there is such a being. And when he shoots his arrow, what is the arrow? It's flowers. It's actually flowers. We used to have, did you take it down? We used to have, I have a nice carving of Rati, Cupid's wife. And she's like this, shooting her bow. Anyway. When people are struck by the arrow of Cupid, I mean, they go a little. They lose their ability to discriminate. They think they're walking a few inches off the ground, and the sky's always sunny, and all the rest of the things that one experiences when they feel love. So, in other words, it's a very high, it's a peak experience. It's a peak experience, really. If we think about peak experiences that the soul can go through, I mean, we could argue that there's probably a few, but really there's four. There's four. You can insert some others if you like. What are the four peak experiences that a soul will go through in a lifetime? Most souls will go through them, not all. Not all souls will go through all four. They go through for sure two.
Birth and death.
Birth, death. Those are the two peak experiences. There's your bookends, your wraparound, right? Love. Right, that's peak experience. Orgasm, we could argue, is a peak experience, right? Now, there may be others, but those we pretty much can agree on as peak experiences. And that's what people want. Do you get peak experiences like all day long, every day? No. Why? Because you discombobulate. You wouldn't be able to handle it. You couldn't cope with it. Oh, really? You know. I mean, birth and death. It's usually a big space in between. I mean, there are other kinds of peak experience. I mean, you could read a book and have a peak experience. You could watch a movie. You could go to a concert and have a peak experience. There's different things. You could be in a car accident. You could have a near-death experience and have a peak experience. So there's others. But he's so beautiful. Krishna appears in this vision that Brahma has, finally, that his unique loveliness charms millions of Cupids. Everyone is charmed by Cupid. In other words, charmed by love. He's the god of love. But Cupid, millions of Cupids are charmed by this figure of Krishna as his flute. So this gives you such a striking image of how compelling the beauty, Krishna's beauty, is. It's like if he showed up here, right, or if you heard the sound of the flute, you would absolutely drop everything. You drop your cup of tea and whatever else. When Krishna would play his flute in Vrindavan, all the animals would. It was so compelling. It was so transcendental. It was so pleasing and so captivating. Exactly. So that's what Brahma arrived at by chanting Kim Krishnaya Govinda Gopi Jana Vallabhaya Swaha. So give it a try, see how it goes. Okay, we don't have to keep it too late. Let's do a little more chanting. Any questions, comments? Doesn't matter. Okay. Go ahead.
Because I really struggle sometimes
with
homosexuality. Mm-hmm. I'm just wondering what happens. Is a soul just so identified with a previous incarnation, maybe the opposite gender than they're expressing in this lifetime?
Some souls, if the last life was a real powerful life, powerful meaning that one was fully expressing oneself in that body. You know, some people are really there, how do we say, comfortable in your own skin. You're really in your body, you're present, you love it, and you're expressing. And some people are not like that at all. They're not comfortable in their own skin, or sometimes they're walking around, but you can see they're not actually in their body. They're not really. They're floating out there someplace. So if somebody has a powerful life where they're really present in a body, say, as a man, okay, and he's got a real strong attraction to women. Polar opposite. Now he comes into his next life as a woman. So his attraction or taste or what he's drawn to is women. That's his imprint from past life. So that's an example of it. Is that true in every case? No, not necessarily. In the Vedic tradition, homosexuality's always been there. If you look at Sanskrit, you've got three genders in Sanskrit language. Most languages that have genders, such as Spanish, or Italian, or French, have two genders, masculine and feminine. So the words are either, you know, masculine or feminine words. That doesn't mean they're feminine necessarily. But in Sanskrit, there's three genders. there's strilingam, feminine gender, there's punglingam, masculine gender, and kleeblingam, neuter. So neuter is that. You can read it in various stories in the Vedas. There are, you know, either eunuchs. Eunuchs were, you know, but you read a lot about that historically, eunuchs. Or, I mean, people who are, it's like a person is female, but they're in a male body. Or they're male, but they're in a female body. It's difficult karma to deal with. And a lot of the people who have to deal with that are very troubled. And they go through identity crises. And generally they do that in their teen years, which for any regular person who's vibrating in harmony with the gender that they have, it's bad enough. Becoming who you are, realizing your individuality while going through puberty and getting a sense of your identity, it's difficult. Yet, being in a body that you think is foreign to what you feel inside. It's not easy karma at all. It's difficult karma. I have many, many, many gay and lesbian clients, and I have had for years, from all parts of the world. And it depends, you know, some of them are very comfortable in their sexuality, and some of them are not. Back in the 90s, from the early 90s, when I was in LA, I had a lot of gay clients come to me, a lot of gay boys coming to me, because being gay in LA, I mean, there's a lot of scope for it, a lot of scope. You know, big cities, there's more scope for it. And, you know, you've got your spots and your area and all that stuff. But that's when there was an outbreak of AIDS and HIV. So I was right there watching all that. And what I learned from that, of course, this is not a scientific study, but this was my experience with a lot of these gay boys, I say boys, men, were coming to see me. And what I discovered was the ones that were real comfortable in their sexuality, and it wasn't a big issue, and they weren't having an identity crisis, and they didn't really care about society and society's opinions, what to speak of family. I mean, that's the real difficulty, is, you know, coming out to your family. You know, and or if you're a prominent person in society, coming out, it's difficult. Anyway, the ones that were comfortable generally were fine. The ones that were struggling with guilt the most and feeling guilty about their sexual orientation or having let down their family or not being accepted in the norm of society, those are the ones that got AIDS. Those were the ones that contracted HIV back in those days. And I saw many examples of it. Again, I don't claim it to be a scientific study, but, you know, that's my experience. I have gay couples, men and women, that have been clients of mine for 25 years. So I've talked to them for years and years and years, you know, over time. So, I mean, you have the ones that are just in relationship. And then, of course, then you have the ones that are out of control, which is usually the younger ones. When I say out of control, I mean, you know, sometimes the energy is It's like anything else, though. Your energy could be in whatever chakra you put your energy into. If people are obsessed with sex and sexuality, whether they're gay or straight, then your energy is all focused in the second chakra. You know, if you want to be gay, then be gay. But we don't need to know about your sexual orientation. You know, it's not that important. Just like if we're heterosexual, we don't have to go on and on about being heterosexual or orientation, you know. So, but that really, it's not so much about being gay. It depends on consciousness. You know, what are you focused on? You know. But it's not an easy karmic birth, because, you know, life is difficult enough as is without having this on top, when you're effectively having an identity crisis. I know many gay men who never never played it out. They just won't. They just... I said, well, have you been in a relationship? No. Have you thought about it? Yeah. Can't bring myself to do it. And I've met many who aren't gay, but they're being gay. That also happens.
That's sad.
I think that's very prevalent in society at the moment.
This one guy said one time, I was so moving, I was shocked. This man was in so much pain. He's about 40s, you know, in his 40s. I listened to him. He said, he was in front of a bunch of people. We were at Louise Hay's house. I was in her house with, you know, doing a Wednesday night program. She was doing it. And a lot of gay boys would come there. Lots. And he says, I'm a gay man, but I'm not a gay man. I don't want to be a gay man. I don't know how not to be a gay man. I don't know how to get out of it. And I've suffered all these years since I was 16. You're wondering, well... He said, I went out with this girl when I was 16. I think it might have been like a prom or a graduation or some big date, you know. Not just a date, but some occasion, if I remember correctly. And he got home late. You know, he took the girl home. He got home a little later. And his mother's sitting up, you know. Where were you? Well, we were just, you know, we've all done it. Well, we did this and that, and it took a little longer, and, you know, nothing happened. Nothing happened between him and the girl. And she says, what if you make that girl pregnant? You'll ruin her life. That's what she told him. If you get that girl pregnant, you will ruin her life. Now here's a 16-year-old looking at his mother in the dark of night. You know what your mother says, what your parents say. These are powerful statements when you're a kid. This man was a lovely man. He was a boy who did not want to ruin anyone's life. The last thing he could imagine was himself ruining some poor girl's life by getting her pregnant. It had such an impact on him that he couldn't go near women. He was attracted to women. He was attracted to girls. That's what he wanted. And he could never, from that day forward, bring himself to go out with another girl. So when he got into his early 20s and his, you know, his sexual interest became too strong, there was only one thing for him to do, and that was to become a gay man. And so there he was at 40, sitting there, tears rolling down his face. I'm a gay man, but I'm not a gay man. I don't want to be a gay man anymore, but I don't know what to do. Yeah. The other thing I learned over the years was there's two kinds of gay people. And I'm careful when I talk about these subjects. I don't talk about them too often. There's two kinds of gay people. The ones that are born, the ones that are made. He's made. He wasn't born that way. He was made into a gay man for the reasons given. The ones that are born, that's fine. You know, and they discover that they're different, and we spoke about that. The ones that are made, more often than not, I'm talking mostly about men now, are made because of a dominant mother figure, more often than not. I've seen it astrologically over and over and over with clients. The mother is messed up. And whatever she does, because it's different in so many cases, this guy has a twisted relationship, or I should say correctly, she has a twisted relationship with her son, and she projects all kinds of stuff on him. I won't even get into all those details. And so he becomes confused, or he becomes victimized by her, or he just knows she's making me nuts. This is what women are like. I can't go anywhere near them because of my childhood with my mother. Let me just stay with the boys. I know I'll be safe, because I can't play that out anymore. Very common. Women, when their husbands aren't around, will project their sexuality on their sons, usually the oldest son. So, how do you think I look? Do you like me in this? Which has nothing to do with the son at all. But that's common. And then the ones that actually have sex with the son. Quite a few of those. These are made. That's how they get made. Not born, necessarily. I've seen many, many examples.
Not a lesbian woman that leave their marriage.
Well, that's... Now, with women, it's different. And I've seen lots of those. With the women that I've seen, I mean, generally 40s, 50s, 60s. They've been in a marriage that does not satisfy them, kind of in any way. Maybe not sexually, physically, maybe almost always not emotionally. Oftentimes these women are very spiritual people, because women are more spiritually inclined than men are in this day and age. So there's all these things that, well, I'm not getting my needs met physically, I'm not getting my needs met emotionally, I'm not getting my needs met spiritually. What am I doing? I've been in for 20 years. Why am I doing this? Then they find a woman with whom they have a meeting of the minds. That's really what it's about. Those women who are not really lesbians become such later on, but it's not really about that as much as it's about the emotional connection and the loving reciprocation. And then if they're also spiritual, then we have all this to share. And then we may also include the physical. but it's generally different with them. I'm not saying there aren't young lesbians who, yeah, sure, there are women that are born lesbians, no doubt. But I'm telling you, the vast majority of what I've seen, that's what I've seen in the last 20 years. I'm in this position, I'm in a kind of a unique position where I get to hear all this stuff from people that they would not normally talk about. So that's how I see it. I take them as souls. You know, I look at them as souls, and what does this soul need, or how can I help this soul at this point in time and on the journey? You know, I don't really care what their orientation is. You know, I've dealt with rapists, murderers, and child molesters. Not a lot of those. They don't usually queue up to see me. But I've had a few. Anyway, so we're all souls on the journey. And we all need help. We all need understanding. We all need comfort. We all need recognition. This is a difficult journey. It is not easy. And we become confused. It's very easy to become confused in the material world. In fact, it's more easy to become confused than it is to gain clarity for most people. It's a simple fact. So I recommend Kling Krishnaya Govindaya Gopi Janavalabhaya Swaha.